If I give you a pop quiz, who is Mary and Joseph? Well, who's everyone going to say? Oh, well, Mary is the mother of Jesus, and Joseph was the adopted kind of stepfather, right? If I say who's Mary and Joseph, that's who you'd think of. Well, we're looking at Mary and Joseph today, but not the ones you're thinking of. A different Mary. The title isn't quite as clever as it could be because there's two Marys, which kind of ruins it, but that's okay. Only one Joseph, at least. Last week, we saw the final moments of the life of Jesus, and we saw him take the penalty of sin. We saw him kind of receive the wrath of God, the punishment that all of mankind deserves in order to make salvation possible. We saw how his death paid a ransom, that's the biblical word, a ransom, to redeem us if we would put our faith in him. And we pick it back up there in Matthew chapter 27 with Jesus having died. Okay, Jesus died, and we're going to see that in our passage today, although Jesus' body is involved, he's really not the focus. You know, as we've gone for 27 chapters now, Jesus has kind of been the focus, but not so much today. We saw the miraculous signs that accompanied his death. If you remember, there was the veil that was torn open. There was this crazy earthquake that led to dead people rising from the grave. And we all know how the story ends. We all know what's going to happen next week. If you don't, spoiler alert, Jesus is going to resurrect. If you didn't know, Jesus is going to resurrect. I'm sorry if I just ruined the movie for you. But Jesus is coming back. He's going to come back once and for all and show his power over death. And in churches and in songs and in sermons and in Bible studies, you hear lots of people going on and on and on talking about the death of Jesus or the crucifixion of Jesus, the cross of Christ. And you hear lots of people talking about the hope of the resurrection, right? The crucifixion and the resurrection. And they just kind of jump over, they skip over what's in the middle of that. And that's his burial. And you might say, well, yeah, they skip over it because it really doesn't matter. Jesus was buried. Who cares? Well, evidently this matters because in 1 Corinthians chapter 15, the Apostle Paul gives kind of a brief summary of the gospel, which is the basic truth of Christianity. And he says there are three events that he includes in his kind of gospel summary. He says Christ died for our sins according to the Bible. Then he says, and he was buried. And then he says, he was raised on the third day. So evidently, this burial matters. And it's not just kind of a footnote, like a little passing comment. But no, evidently, there's something to learn for us here in the funeral of Jesus. I would assume everyone here has gone to a funeral. Anyone here never attend a funeral? This is the Philippines, so Filipinos, they go to funerals. They go to all kinds of funerals. Funerals last, I think, for like 7 years in this country, right? Okay, so we know what a funeral's like, but this is a funeral to never forget. Okay, Matthew doesn't skip over this, Paul doesn't skip over it, and we're not going to either. In fact, Matthew slows down a little bit and he shows us who was watching, kind of what took place, who was involved. He explains how the enemies responded to this funeral of Christ. And we pick it up in verse 55 of Matthew chapter 27. So in verse 55, it says, and many women who followed Jesus from Galilee, ministering to him, were there looking on from afar, among whom were Mary Magdalene, Mary the mother of James and Joseph, and the mother of Zebedee's sons. The mother of Zebedee's sons, just kind of an interesting kind of way to say that. It's the wife of Zebedee, the mother of their children. So Matthew here draws our attention to a surprising group of people that are following him. Because if you remember, the disciples, they had all left. Okay, they're gone. They'd had enough. It had got too hard. Most of them had scattered at this point. Matthew doesn't talk about the crowds that are there, but instead he focuses on these women. He says there's this large group of women. Okay, there's a group of them, but then he says there's three in particular there, and they've been following Jesus since he was in Galilee. So they've been following Jesus for some time now. And we don't know a lot about them, but there's something for us to learn from each of them. Okay, number one, there's Mary Magdalene, and he or she is perhaps the one we know the most about. But you might right now think you know stuff about her that isn't actually true. You know why? Because there was a pope who got confused when he was studying the Bible, and he made some comments that weren't true of her. I don't think he did it with, like, trying to mislead. I just think that despite what some people teach, the pope can actually make mistakes. And he just went off and said some stuff that wasn't true, and people have now been clinging to that for a long time. And if it's more trivia than too important, but a lot of people are convinced that the Bible teaches that she was a prostitute. Nope. But a pope got confused with a different woman in the Bible and just kind of combined them. Okay. So, but there is stuff we do know about her. You can find her interacting with Jesus in the Gospel of Luke, chapter 8, verse 2. Jesus runs into her, and she is demon-possessed. Okay, she's demon-possessed, her life is rough, things aren't going well, and Jesus actually casts seven demons out of her. So, why do I bring her up? Well, she is an example of someone who therefore is radically transformed by the grace of Jesus. When Jesus comes into her life changes. When you go from having seven demons in you to being demon-free, it's a big change in your life. So Mary here is reminding us that those who have been deeply rescued, who have been saved from severe, severe sin, difficulty, fallenness, often become the most devoted. She is there to the very end. There's real loyalty there. Loyalty that the Apostle Peter didn't have. Now we get to the next Mary. Mary, the mother of James and Joseph. James later, this James, the Bible gets, there's a lot of James that are in this kind of group. Okay, there's James who is the brother of Jesus. This isn't that James. There is James who was another apostle who wrote the book of James. This isn't that James. And then here's this third James. Later, he's called James the Lesser. Like, it's kind of insulting. Like, if there's, you know, for a while we had two Johns here, and imagine if one of them is like John the less important. Okay, but that's what he was called. I think it's because he was younger. Okay, I think it's because he was younger. So I'm not sure which John was younger, but don't be insulted if you turn out to be John the Lesser. So we don't know much about her. Every time she's spoken about, it's kind of in connection to her children. She never gets the spotlight. She never gets any attention. She's the mother of James and Joseph, and she's known more for who her children are than anything else. She's always mentioned in humble terms, not front and center. And yet, here she is present at a very key moment. She was there when it mattered. Right? She might not have been the star. She wasn't Peter. She wasn't James. She wasn't John. She wasn't one of the stars. And yet there she is when she's needed. There she is at one of the times when it mattered most. Again, we have something to learn from her. And then lastly, there's this woman who we don't even see her name here. Right? It says that she's the mother of Zebedee's sons. The mother of Zebedee's sons. Mark records another woman who was there named Salome, and it's believed that that would be her. Okay? So, what do we know about her? You know the one thing we know about her is a few chapters ago, she came up to Jesus in arrogance and self-confidence and said, "Hey, Jesus, I want you to take my sons and put one on your right hand, one on your left hand, because they're really important and I want to feel important too." That's my summary of what she said. And Jesus really corrects that attitude, right? That's where then he explains that, no, in the kingdom of heaven, the greatest will become the least. The greatest is the one who is a servant of all. You guys can't even handle this responsibility that your mother is asking for. So Jesus pretty sternly rebukes her, corrects her. So what do we learn from her? Well, for me, this is perhaps one of the most impressive things to learn, is that she actually took the rejection, the correction and rebuke, and here she is still loving and loyal to Christ, because most people can't handle it. Most people, when they get corrected, they say, "You know what? Forget you. I'm done with you then. Jesus, you made me look like a fool in front of my friends, in front of my kids. I'm not following you anymore." She didn't. She said, "Yep, that was right. I was dumb. I'm going to listen. I'm going to humble myself. I'm still going to love and follow you." Again, most can't handle that. Most refuse. But here's these three women. Again, not a lot of detail given, but Matthew says they're there, and he did it for a reason. So I didn't want to just blow by and say, "Oh, these people are watching." No, there's a reason he brings up that these women are there. But the crucifixion at this point is over. Jesus is dead. Jesus is dead. So there's really not, like, what are they waiting for? There's not much else to do. Historically, what would normally happen after someone is crucified, you know what it is? Nothing. The body would stay there until it would get so decayed and just from the elements, from nature, from the heat and natural decay. You've all walked by some dead animals, you know what happens. Then eventually it would fall from the cross and then get eaten by the birds and rodents and dogs. That's what would happen to most criminals. And Rome did that on purpose, because Rome wanted everyone to see these dead, decaying, disgusting bodies and be reminded, "Hey, I don't want to commit any crimes against Rome. I don't want to end up like that guy. I don't want to be killed like them." Once in a while, they would need the upright posts where people were crucified before that would happen. So they would remove the body and throw them into an open pit full of other criminals. Okay, so there's no burial, no funeral, no honor given. Just kind of thrown into an open pit. The place where this is happening is Golgotha, which is known as the place of the skull. And some people who have done far more research than me believe that's because the bodies would be thrown into a hole and there'd be so many skulls there to see. So that's what they would really be expecting to happen now. That's exactly what everyone would have expected for Jesus. His body left to rot, maybe tossed into a pit with the others. That was the fate of the crucified. But there's a detail buried kind of deep in the Old Testament in Isaiah chapter 53. And if people were really studying their Bible, they might have known, wait a minute, that's not what's going to happen. Because in Isaiah chapter 53, verse 9, it says of the Messiah that he was assigned a grave with the wicked. He was assigned a grave with the wicked, meaning you'd expect him to be thrown in the hole with the wicked and the criminals. He was assigned that, right? We saw him crucified with criminals on both sides. He died right with them. But then it goes on and says, but with the rich, he'll be in his death. So in other words, although he died the death of a criminal and you would expect him to be thrown in a pit like a common criminal. Instead, he will be buried like someone honored. Now, no one would expect that. You just watched Jesus killed. No one would expect that this is what was going to happen. But God was quietly working to fulfill his plan, even in these funeral arrangements. Now, there's a problem. Tombs were expensive. Burying people with the rich people was expensive, and Jesus had no money. Remember, it was time for him to pay taxes one time, and he reaches into his pocket, and he's like, I got nothing. Just go catch a fish. There'll be a coin in its mouth. So he had no money. His followers, they gave up their job 3 years ago. They don't have any money. And you might think, oh, well, I'm sure his family will take care of him. No, they don't have any money either. If you remember back in Luke chapter 2, Joseph and Mary are going to the temple to offer a sacrifice. The sacrifice should have been a lamb. That's what people sacrificed. But in the book of Leviticus, there's an exception that if you're really poor, it's not that rich people had lambs, it's that the average person had lambs. If you're really poor and you can't afford to sacrifice a lamb, you can bring two pigeons. And in Luke chapter 2, you know what Joseph and Mary were bringing? Not a lamb, but pigeons. There's actually two different birds that are options. I don't remember what they are right now, but the pigeons is the cheaper one, and that's what they had. Okay, so they didn't have any money. And that was when Joseph was alive. At this point, Joseph's dead. Somewhere along the way, Joseph died, leaving Mary even more worse off than she was before. So who's going to take care of this? Like, how can this happen? Right now, if you knew Isaiah 53, verse 9, you'd think, God, you must have made a mistake. Like, there's no way Jesus is getting an impressive tomb. It can't happen. Well, we know that God's not wrong. He never is wrong. So what's he going to do? We find out in verse 57. Now when evening had come, there came a rich man from Arimathea named Joseph. So God sends some rich guy to come. His name's Joseph, and it says, who himself had become a disciple of Jesus. So somewhere along the way, we don't know when, this Joseph of Arimathea had become a follower of Christ. He had become a disciple. Verse 58, this man went to Pilate and asked for the body of Jesus. Then Pilate commanded the body to be given to him. So here we see this new character. He has not shown up anywhere else in the Bible. The only time that Joseph of Arimathea is discussed is in the burial of Jesus, but he is discussed in all four of the Gospels. So for some reason, this guy is important enough that Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John all give us some details. And when you kind of put them all together, you find in Mark that this guy, he was a member of the Sanhedrin Council. And if you don't remember what the Sanhedrin Council is, that's one of the two councils that one day previous had condemned Jesus to death. This guy is a respected member of that council. So he was a well thought of religious figure, well respected in the religious community. But then in Luke, we find that although he was a member of that council, he was just, righteous, and good are the words that we see. And Luke records that Joseph did not go along with, he did not consent to the condemnation of Christ. Okay, so whenever the voting happened, you know, should we kill Jesus or should we not? Joseph said, no, we're not doing this. This isn't right. We can't do this. Which kind of makes sense, right? If he was a follower of Jesus and he was a disciple of Jesus, you'd hope he's not going to vote to have Jesus killed. And then the Gospel of John gives us another detail. He also says that this guy is a follower of Jesus, but it says that Joseph kept his faith hidden out of fear and shame of what others would think. He didn't want the Jews to know. He didn't want the Jews to know that he actually followed Jesus, so he kept it secret. He was a secret disciple of Christ. He didn't want anyone to know, at least before right now. Because right now, what he is doing, everyone is going to know. He'll be able to remain a secret disciple hidden in the Sanhedrin Council no longer, because he's about to make his faith very, very public. So he's no longer willing to keep his loyalty and commitment to Jesus private. And what we're going to discuss here is that doing so is going to cost him a lot. For him to go public with his faith is going to cost him a lot. And I say that because for you to publicly, fully commit to Christ is going to cost you a lot. It's going to cost you a lot. It has since the very beginning, since the beginning of Christianity, since the crucifixion before the resurrection, it was costing people a lot to follow Jesus. So, sorry. I'm sorry that true discipleship isn't comfortable. I'm sorry it's not convenient. I'm sorry that it demands courage, that it demands sacrifice, and that it demands cost. And I really wish I could sit up here and lie to you and say it doesn't. I wish I could tell you, well, Christianity is going to be easy. Jesus never has you do anything hard, and it's always a ton of fun. But I can't, because I've read the Bible, and we, at this church, teach the Bible. So you need to know what you signed up for. Joseph knew what he was getting into. He knew what it was going to cost. First of all, he had to go to Pilate. If you remember when we first talked about Pilate, Pilate was famous for killing Jews whenever they would become kind of inconvenient and annoying to him. It's like, I don't really like you. I'm going to have you killed. And Joseph has to go to Pilate and interrupt him and say, you know, that guy who you killed and normally you would just let rot, will you allow me? Let me interrupt you. Would you let me take his body? Now, to do that, people would accuse him of having kind of sympathy for this political criminal. It's like, you're a sympathizer, and that's no good. You know what they did to the people who sympathized with political criminals? Killed them just like the political criminals themselves. So first, he had to kind of break out of that comfort zone. So would you risk your own comfort, your own safety to honor Christ? Joseph did. Also, he broke out of the religion, right? He was part of the Jewish council. And I'm just guessing the next day, they're not letting him back in. Like, if he shows up to the office on Monday, the security guards are going to say, you're not welcome here. So he breaks out of this religious system that he's been a part of his whole life. He had to leave the religious system that shaped his culture, the religious system that shaped his identity, because for him to honor the death of Jesus, he could be part of that religion no longer. You know why? Because that religion didn't think Jesus was enough. That religion did not sing songs about Jesus being enough. They thought, no, there's a bunch of other things that you need to do to be right with God. Jesus isn't enough. And I don't want to be vague here. I'm not trying to be overly insulting, but I also want to very clearly connect the dots. Here in this country, there's a religious system that has shaped the identity and the culture of this nation that also doesn't think Jesus is enough and that you need to add other things to him for salvation. And if you're going to honor the death of Christ, you may find that you have to break out of that religious system of thinking. So to be a follower of Jesus will require breaking away from previously held beliefs. Requires rejecting familiar paths. But I'll tell you, just to give you a little positive note here, it's way better on the other side. Joseph had to be in secret his whole time, and he couldn't be honest about who he was. But once he came out, went away from this religious system, he could worship God in public. No more shame, no more fear, because he had already paid the cost. So, he broke apart from his community, he lost his friends. Again, they're not going to take him back. It means he lost his job. And I'll tell you, if you boldly become a follower of Jesus, you kind of shout with your life that you're a follower of Christ and everyone sees it, your family and friends are going to think you're crazy. They just are. If they don't, I'm not saying all the time, like your family's not going to always think you're crazy, but if your family never thinks a decision that you make for Christ is crazy, you're not making the right decisions. Or you have a really, 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 really amazing family that I've never met. Okay, there's going to come a time where your family might think, this is weird. Why'd you choose to do this? There's going to come a time where your friends are like, you're going to choose that? Yeah. Yeah, I am. So that's what it takes to follow Jesus. And that's a cost that Joseph here is paying. And he's not done yet paying a cost. Verse 59, when Joseph had taken the body, he wrapped it in a clean linen cloth and he laid it in his new tomb, which he had hewn out of the rock. And he rolled the large stone against the door of the tomb and he departed. What's crazy is that's all we know of Joseph. We just read everything that the Bible says. And yet, there's still more for us to learn here. First, it says that he dug, the word there is hewn. He went and dug the tomb. I don't know how many of you have ever dug a hole big enough to put a body in, but I bet it's not easy. And I really bet it's not easy when you're doing it out of stone. Okay, and there's no explosive, there's no heavy equipment, there's no diesel generators yet, no jackhammers. So this was some work. And I say that because following Christ is going to be work, physical work. You're going to be tired. There's going to be times where Jesus has you serve and you're kind of tired and he puts people in your life and you want to go to bed, but some stranger's standing in front of you with some kind of need or he wants you to talk to them and you'd rather sleep, but you can't. There'll come a time where you go with your friends and you do a missions trip and you shovel sand and gravel all day long and you're just exhausted. And that's a good thing. It's a good thing. So it cost him just some physical work. But also, this was his tomb. And I did some research for what a tomb would cost. And, you know, there's a lot of math to do. First, you're converting to like 12 different currencies. And then you're trying to figure out, well, what is that worth today? So I'm not going to say this is the most accurate, you know, number in the world. But estimates are that the tomb would be worth 1.5 million pesos. Okay, so a significant amount of money. That's what a tomb would cost. So he put in the work and dug it, and it was valuable. It was new. This wasn't used. He had just dug this. And in the Gospel of John, we find out that, first of all, we find out that he's not alone. There's another guy with him. Nicodemus is there helping him, which is kind of interesting because if you know anything about Nicodemus, Nicodemus originally came to Jesus at night. In John chapter 3, you can read his story. And he came to Jesus at night because he was too afraid to be seen talking to Jesus before. So here are these two people that at one point were afraid to be associated with Christ, now kind of boldly proclaiming their loyalty to Christ. But Nicodemus is there. And not only did Joseph pay for the tomb, but he pays for these burial spices, which, you know, for us, it's like spices. Sounds kind of weird, right? But that was a common practice. It was kind of a cleansing oil and fragrant smells. It was a way to kind of prepare the body for burial. They used 35 kilos of burial spices. I don't know what the average amount is, but I do know that that's way more. Okay, that's a lot. 35 kilos. You know what's crazy? The spices, the oil and the fragrant things that they're using is actually way more valuable than the tomb itself. About a little over 5 million pesos for these spices. So there's great financial loss here. great financial loss here. There's one other guy besides Joseph of Arimathea that Matthew describes as rich. Only two times in his gospel does he call people rich. One here is Joseph, who gladly gave up what he had in service to honor Christ. And the other guy is the rich young ruler, who refused to give up what he had and left Jesus sad and full of sorrow. Why? Well, because Joseph saw that Jesus was worth the sacrifice. Joseph saw that anything he had came from God anyways, and was glad to give it up. Rich young ruler, no, this is mine. Jesus, keep your hands off of it. Now, there's another way that he paid financially, because he was a member of the Sanhedrin, and like I said, when he shows up to work on Monday, they're not letting him in. So not only did he sacrifice money, but now he's sacrificing his career. And I say that because both of those will be necessary for you in your commitment to God. I don't know what he's going to call you to give to, but to commit to God, it will require sacrificial giving. It will. And it might be in your support of God's mission, and it might also include the giving up of potential income, such as, well, I won't take this job that interferes with church. I won't take this job that interferes with what God's called me to. I know you want to give me a promotion, and I want to be a good worker, and I'm going to serve you well, but that promotion comes with responsibilities that would interfere with what God's called me to, so I can't do it. So I'm going to actually stay at my lower wage. Sorry. It might just take that. It took that for Joseph. It might take that for you. And then there's probably like 50 more ways if we really analyze where this cost him. But one other way, by doing what he's doing, he's becoming what the Bible calls is ceremonially unclean. Okay? So he's ceremonially unclean. For the Jews, they had all these rules. You can read about it. It's not the most exciting read, but you can read starting kind of towards the end of Exodus. You can read Exodus and Leviticus, and you can read Deuteronomy, and you find all of these laws. And if the Jews broke some of those laws, some of these expectations, it would make them be ceremonially unclean, which meant that they could not partake in religious festivals and gatherings and holidays until they did whatever action the Bible required to become clean again. There'd be sacrifices you have to make, time that you would have to allow to pass. Touching the dead body, you were unclean for at least 7 days. Okay? At least 7 days. So there they are, touching a dead body. So you're going to be unclean for 7 days, which you might think, well, that's no big deal. Wait a minute. This is Passover time. Passover is the biggest, most important festival of the year. Passover is the greatest family reunion that would happen for these guys. And they're choosing that honoring Christ was more important than being part of Passover. More important than being part of the festival. More important than the celebration. More important than the family reunion. Okay, for them to honor God was more important than the party, more important than the holiday dinner. Even if mom was there and dad was there and grandpa was there and grandma was there and my aunts and my uncles, and this is the one time that I see them, they didn't care. And I say that because it's going to happen to you. It's going to happen to you where there's going to come a time where what culture around you desires to happen is going to contradict with putting God first. I've had what I would just call absolutely ridiculous excuses that people give. You may find yourself insulted by this right now. None of you have at this point given me this excuse, but I've had people say, well, I know this missions trip is important. I know that serving God is important. I know that this is what I should do, but it's my sister's 6th birthday party. If God's not more important than some birthday cake, there's something wrong with your heart. Okay, now I'm not saying you can never miss something, okay? I'm saying that we're supposed to actually put the kingdom of God first, and that's going to require saying no to something once in a while. It's going to. These guys chose to miss out on the party. They chose to miss out on the holiday to honor Christ. A lot of people refuse. A lot of people refuse. So the choice is yours. You get to choose. But when you choose the celebration over God, just don't lie to yourself and say that you're putting the kingdom of God first. Do yourself a favor and admit it. I'm compromising in my faith. I'm putting this above God. Don't try to pretend that you aren't. So Joseph and Nicodemus here, they're done following the cultural expectations. They're done following the religious traditions. They're done fearing the shame and the insult that kept them following Jesus at a distance for their whole life. Now they're boldly, confidently, and at great cost declaring themselves to be followers of Christ. Their life, they are shouting it to all who would watch. They are following Jesus in secret no longer. Verse 61, and Mary Magdalene was there, and the other Mary sitting opposite the tomb. So now we go back to these two women. We've lost the one. Okay, now we're down to two. And if you remember back in verse 55, they were there with a great crowd. The great crowd is gone. No, it's just these two. Here we find these women are still there. And they stayed with Jesus to the very end. I mean, they stayed with him until you can't stay any longer. The stone's going. The stone's being rolled in front of the door. You got to leave. And I'll tell you that it is the people who refuse to give up and those who refuse to leave until all the work is done that get to experience the greatest things of God. You know how many times I've gotten to be part of something cool just because I didn't go home? That they gave me an office at the church and made me a pastor just because I wouldn't leave. They're like, just go home, Jesse. And I was like, no, I want to be here. They're like, fine, we'll give you an office. It's partly true, actually. But then they kicked me out and sent me to a different country. No, but the people who are most committed to God get to see the greatest stuff. And I say that because these two, they're not only there till the end, but you know who's going to show up first next week when we get to Matthew chapter 28? These women. They were there till the end, and they're the first one at the tomb. They're the first one to find out Jesus resurrected. He's not in here anymore. Verse 62, on the next day, which followed the day of preparation, the chief priests and the Pharisees, they gathered together to Pilate, saying, Sir, we remember, while he was still alive, how the deceiver said, After 3 days I will rise. Therefore command that the tomb be made secure until the third day, lest his disciples come by night and steal him away, and say to the people, He has risen from the dead, so that the last deception will be worse than the first. So these people, they come to Pilate, and they're like, you know, we remember Jesus said he was going to rise from the dead, and I bet that the disciples of Christ are going to come, and they're going to steal his body, and they're going to say, you know what, he resurrected. So we need to guard his body, we need to secure it, so that that cannot happen. They didn't want it to happen. So Pilate, let's set a guard to protect it so that no one can steal the body. I also think they're thinking that, well, and then if he actually does come back to life, we can kill him again by leaving him locked in the tomb. So there's no way that he's coming back. Well, verse 65 there, Pilate said to them, You have a guard. Go your way. Make it as secure as you know how. When you first read that, you would think that Pilate's saying, No, I'm not going to give you a guard. You have your own. But what he's saying when you look into it is really, you have the guard that I'm giving you, so take a guard and go and secure it. Okay, so there's the Roman soldiers going to secure the tombstone of Jesus. So they went and they made the tomb secure, sealing the stone and setting the guard. What's kind of crazy is Jesus kept telling his disciples over and over and over, I'm going to rise again. I'm going to die, but in 3 days I'm coming back. Jesus told them that clearly. We've seen it in Matthew 16, 21, 17, 23, 20, 19. Over and over, I'm coming back. That's what the disciples heard. The Pharisees didn't get such clear instruction. There was one time where the Pharisees were demanding a sign from Jesus. Like, give us a sign to prove that you're so impressive. And Jesus says, the only sign you're going to get is the sign like the days of Jonah. And if the Son of Man will go into the earth, 3 days later he'll come back. That's it. And then another time, he's talking about the temple, and he says, you know, if you destroy the temple, I can raise it again. So Jesus didn't say it that clearly to the Pharisees, and yet here the Pharisees are saying, Jesus says he's coming back. So it's kind of ironic that the enemies of Jesus are more prepared and more expecting the resurrection than his closest friends. So the Jewish officials here, they take actions to seal up the tomb and secure it in a way that the disciples can't get his body, which means that no one is ever going to be able to lie and say the disciples stole his body. People try to say that. Oh, the disciples, they took the body of Jesus. No, the Romans made sure that that didn't happen. No, the Jews made sure that didn't happen. So the funny thing is that without realizing it, the Jewish leaders and the Roman government kind of join forces to help prove the reality of the resurrection and disprove all the lies that, well, Jesus didn't actually resurrect. So without realizing it, they're proving the resurrection. By their extreme care, their diligence to secure the tomb, instead of preventing the resurrection as they intended, they prove the truth of it to the world. There's one author, you may have heard of him, his name is J.C. Ryle, and he writes this on that same idea. He says, they didn't give much thought to what they were doing. They gave little thought that unknowingly they were providing the most complete evidence of the truth of Christ's resurrection. They were actually making it impossible to say that there was deception. Their seal, their guard, all of their precautions would become witnesses in just a few hours that Christ actually rose. They might as well have tried to stop the tides of the sea or to prevent the sun from rising as to prevent Jesus from coming forth from the tomb. But they were taken in their own craftiness. Their own devices became instruments to show forth God's glory. So they go and they want to prove that Jesus is dead and that he's not coming back. What are they going to do? Because despite this, one more spoiler for you, Jesus is coming back. They can put their guard, they can do all that they want to try to prevent it, to say it didn't happen, but they won't be able to. So Jesus was dead, but now, not now in the story, but I mean now in whatever the date is. I don't even know what year it is, 2025. Right now, Jesus is alive. Was dead, but now is alive. So Jesus resurrected. And because of that, I'd say that the sacrifice that Joseph of Arimathea, that Nicodemus, that these women made, has proven to be well worth it. It was a high sacrifice. It cost a lot. There's a well-known pastor, Dietrich Bonhoeffer, and he said that when Christ calls a man, when Christ calls someone to follow him, he says he invites him to come and die. I think Joseph knew that. As he dug the tomb for Jesus, in a metaphorical, symbolical way, he's digging it for himself. His life's never going to be the same. It's going to cost him everything. His job's gone. His friend's gone. His religion is gone. He's got to die to it. His life would never be the same. But Jesus warned us that's how it's going to work. Shouldn't be surprised, right? Jesus said, if anyone desires to be my disciple, if anyone wants to follow me, you have to pick up your cross and follow me. So Joseph understood that, and yet he was willing to do it. He could remain a secret disciple of Christ no longer. He wasn't going to be quiet. He wasn't going to hide his affection. He wasn't going to hide his commitment. He wasn't going to compromise in his following of Christ. He was going to be all in. He was going to boldly show with his life that this Jesus that you killed, he is God. Boldly shouting it, this is God. And my hope in the end of this chapter is that we would live a life like him. And when we do, we will find that although it is a high cost and it is sacrifice and it's a pain and there'll be days you want to give up, we will find the truth in Jesus' words that those who would lose their life, if you would lose your life for his sake, will actually find it. But if instead you want to cling to your life, you'll lose it. That's what Jesus says. And we will find that it's true. One way or another, you're going to find that to be true. There's a way to find out that to be true and to celebrate. And there's a way to find out to be that that's true and to be full of sorrow for eternity. Okay, we can accept that the words of Christ are true. Let's lose our life for his sake. We won't regret it. Guys, we won't regret it. Okay, that's the end of Matthew 27, and that's the end of the sermon. And now I just want to, the sermon is, that's official. So like, you know how you're going to edit the sermon? That's where you would end it. But now I want to talk to you very directly as people. What I find is most people hear stuff like this, and they believe it. And they know it's true, and they know it's right, because they believe the Bible. And why can't argue with the Bible? And then day to day, they go and they live their lives, and they just can't bring themselves to pay the cost because what they hold as important isn't Christ. The Bible says to taste and see that the Lord is good. I'm telling you, if you'll do it, you'll have no regret. Joseph in heaven right now, he's not like, man, I wish I had hung on to my spices. Like, just think what I could have done with that oil. You know, just think, I wish that my dead body that I don't care about could have been in that fancy tomb. No, he doesn't care. He doesn't care. So this is my plea that you tomorrow, in very real, practical ways of your life, would be like Joseph. Follow Jesus boldly, confidently. Don't try and hide it. Don't be ashamed of it. But pay the cost and do it with gladness. And that's who we are seeking to be as a church. And it's not the easy version of Christianity. Like, if you wanted the easy version of Christianity, I could probably find you 50 more churches within, you know, a very short walk of here. If you're coming here because this is the closest church to you, I can find you an easier one closer to your house, especially people who come, you know, 2 hours or wherever you're coming from. I could find you a version that's easier, but it's not true, and it will leave you empty and unfulfilled because this is what the Bible says. You can accept it and believe it and live it, or you can pretend to, but really go on living your own life. And that's what most people do. They pretend to accept it. They pretend to agree with it. But in the reality of life, not so much. I say that because that's what I'm tempted to do every day of my life. I want to settle for that. I want what God has for me. I don't want to compromise and settle for less.